Today's program is brought to you by Rolling Press, a family-run, eco-friendly printing company. For more information, visit rollingpress.com.
This is Mike Edison, host of Art Senses a Seizure, as you're listening to the Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, please visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello, this is Joshua David Stein from the Joshua David Stein Variety Hour, Half Hour. I'd like to welcome you to our show today, a show devoted to the pleasures of Indian cuisine, but maybe more specifically how we relate or don't relate to it in kind of contemporary New York restaurant culture. The reason why this show came about is because for my most recent review for the New York Observer, I reviewed a place called Awad in the Upper West Side near my house. And a chef named Gaurav Anand is there. And his cuisine, this restaurant specializes in cuisine from Awad, which is a region, which is an area in Uttar Pradesh in northeast India. And I was blown away by it. I was blown away by so many aspects of it, how he translated this culture, which has there has not been a kind of fine... it's a very refined culture, aristocratic culture, with a very codified cuisine, and in my view, delicious. So I think it's an amazing restaurant that deserves a lot more critical thought. The only person who has written about it before me is this woman, Gail Green, who's great. But like Pete Wells didn't go there, Platt didn't go there. It hasn't gotten a lot of attention, and I started thinking about why do critics, who are for the most part white, not they pay attention to some ethnic cuisines, and they do not pay attention to a certain level of other ethnic cuisines. I'm doing air quotes, but it's radio, so you can't see. So my guest, Krishnendu Ray, is a professor at NYU's School of Education, most recently the author of Curried Culture, and has written a paper. He wrote a paper which kind of answered and laid out exactly all of my thoughts and answered all my questions about kind of ethnic food and the kind of hierarchy of ethnic cultures and critical thought in New York. Krishnendu, welcome.
Thank you.
So last night you ate at Awad.
Yes.
So let's, before we jump into why critics don't pay attention to it, should they even pay attention? You said you had a mixed experience.
The food was fantastic, especially the lamb chop, for instance, and the gilodi kebabs. The tandoor was fantastic. The breads were fantastic. But the service was disastrous. And that's kind of one of the curses of an ethnic restaurant, kind of beyond, we're going to probably talk about reviewing itself, is that they didn't seem to have the script that they were playing. They were trying to both play in an haute cuisine arena, and they were playing with a script, which was basically undertrained staff, and the staff were not exposed to how to treat people who come in at late night reservation. And they sat me down at a table, which was kind of so dark, it was impossible to see.
Right.
And the service was sullen, and which is in some ways a classic problem.
Do you think that is... due to its a sort of cultural misunderstanding of service, or is it just a place with bad service? Like, there's a lot of French places with bad service, for
exactly.
instance, as well.
I have a feeling. I think it's both those things. One is entrepreneurs, and especially immigrant entrepreneurs, don't tend to invest as much on basically their labor and labor training, especially if they come from societies with poor labor costs. They think it's a waste of money. And I think in this case, this place needs attention and investment in training labor, basically. It's partly a question of that. And partly it's a question of what happens in most so-called ethnic restaurants is that service, especially service in what we see in a consumer society, many people are still unfamiliar with it, especially people coming from poorer countries, especially non-white people. Non-white people... for non-white people's lives, service is often very close to servitude, especially in societies like in South Asia, say Bangladesh, India, Pakistan. Hence, service is always done with a certain kind of a resistance to it, because you want to keep your integrity. To keep your integrity, you cannot be enthusiastic about service, because service brings you very close to servitude.
There's something inherently sort of shameful about...
And inferior.
Right.
I would say in some ways you can generalize that also happened in the U.S. until you had servants. Once servants vanish from a society because of levels of development, then service comes back as a pantomime of servitude. And then people can, that's why I would say white people make terrific servers, because they don't have memory of servitude. People who live in close proximity to being servants, are servants, and a history of servitude, do not make very good servers, willing servers in general.
Right,
so that's the second element of it.
Because it's sort of that the identities aren't sufficiently divorced, so they can't be invested professionally in service without feeling it somehow...
Excellent. Right. That's an excellent point. That in some ways, in a sense, it cannot be just a pantomime. If you're a server, there's always a danger in those societies that you might be treated as a servant.
Right.
Okay? And if that possibility exists, there is a kind of a tug of war between the part of it that needs that work and labor and the part of you that, in fact, resists it because of notions of dignity. I mean, that's why I think you can generalize almost on what are all called, what we would classify as ethnic restaurants, which are basically poor people's cuisines in kind of the American history.
What's interesting about Awad is, and I was kind of thinking about it leading into the show, there's a few, maybe four or five other high-end, specifically Indian restaurants. Janoon is the one that obviously like springs to mind.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that sort of, is this a hamp, is this something that will hamper them forever? Or is it hiring maybe second generation, third generation Indian, you know, immigrants, or even... Even if you want to put in color, you know, white servers.
Absolutely. And you see them, people who are playing at the very high end, like, say, Floyd Cardos, right? Or, say, Davies, Suvir, Saran. Or, say, Tamarind and Tulsi, Hemant Mathur, and Survi. They, in some ways, kind of play with that. In some ways, they have a mixed server population, which generally tends to be not of South Asian origin or of the second and the third generation. And you saw that amongst every ethnic group. And so what you're pointing to is this kind of a curse of being an ethnic place. And maybe this is related to your first set of comments on what gets reviewed and what doesn't get reviewed.
Right, because bad service, places with bad service get reviewed all the time.
Yes.
And it's mentioned in the review.
Yeah. I think with Indian food specifically, there's a twofold problem, at least in New York City, which is it is parts of it, most parts. There are about 300 Indian restaurants in New York City, out of which about 10 are high-end, marked by price. And Awad falls kind of in the upper end of it, not the most expensive, as you named. Tamarind, Junoon, Tulsi, Devi are the most expensive ones. And in fact, these days, Floyd has moved out of the ethnic category, and he's playing with a restaurant called White Street which is very interesting food. But he, in fact, found himself confined within the ethnic domain. For a long time in New York City, he couldn't find a job cooking any other food. People said, you're Indian. You'd be good to make chicken tikka masala and
which
nothing else.
Which is crazy.
It is, absolutely.
That's
the ethnic prison house you sometimes kind of get trapped in. And then on the other side is this. And once you classify, an audience classifies a cuisine as ethnic, what you're looking for is cheapness and basically tradition. And you're not paying for innovation. And you don't want to pay for innovation. Innovation you pay in the haute cuisine direction, right? And so in a sense, that's a very different text. So part of my complexity of experiencing Awadh last night was that it was trying to play both the haute cuisine script and the ethnic cuisine script, but and there's a contradiction there.
Right, but that, I think if there's any place that can do that, it would be Awadh, right? Because the cuisine of Awadh is haute cuisine, but
of a different place, of a different set of people.
We call it ethnic.
Exactly.
So that, I mean, that's a thing that I find so frustrating, and which is so well illustrated, so well delineated at Awadh, is that cuisine is a cuisine of the Nawab.
Absolutely.
Right? Very aristocratic, very refined, very rich.
And India and Indian elites have a kind of a very also a romantic attitude towards the Lakhnavi Awadhi elites, because they were the last local elites that were replaced by the British. So there's a rich tradition of music, for instance, that comes, a rich tradition
which
of
we
dance.
Will hear
you will
soon.
Hear later, yes. Yeah. And rich tradition of food, especially this kind of food that Awadh is specializing in, which is dumpukt. Yeah,
but then it gets here and it kind of becomes flattened
exactly.
as ethnic cuisine. Exactly. I think some of my reservations about Awadh, yeah, the service was an issue.
Mm-hmm. You were absolutely cutting, especially about the platinum blonde in the front and at the
I
bar.
Did not like that woman. She was Anglo, by the way, but she was
a terrible server.
She was a bad bartender.
A very bad bartender.
And the other thing that I thought was problematic was that Buddha on the second floor, the disco Buddha covered in mirrors. It's like... it's sort
pastiche
of like
this, of all the exotic
pastiche,
things,
yeah.
all the exotic things pulled together.
And I think that if Gaurav was going to be very successful at kind of pulling off this cuisine as marking it as haute cuisine, then he needs to avoid as much as
absolutely.
Possible.
He should clarify his game, basically,
right.
in a sense that felt like
clarify it like butter.
Absolutely, exactly, and butter absolutely central to this kind of a cooking dumpuk. And but clarify his game where it felt like he was playing. He appeared to be playing kind of to use a metaphor in terms of sports. He appeared to be playing cricket in a baseball diamond. So in a sense, it kind of had this very mixed sense of high-end food and in some ways low-end service, and the lighting there is absurd, where the backstage is overlit and the front stage, which is the most beautiful part of the restaurant, you can't much see because it's so dark.
Right.
And the serving part you can see because it's bright, because they need that light to basically so that they can see what they're serving.
Right.
So it needs attention from the chef, from the restaurateur, to play in that domain of haute cuisine. But Indian food, I think, it's still going to have a difficult time. It is still associated in the American imagination as mostly cheap and spicy.
So in the paper that you had written, mm-hmm. You had kind of talked about how some cuisines like German and French, like French in particular, was at one point ethnic cuisine.
Yes.
And now in some ways it's even in the word haute cuisine, it is the dominant sort of culture. Cultural cuisine.
Or even more dramatically, like, say, Japanese food.
Right.
I mean, if you look at any of the award listing best restaurants in the world, you will basically have today Western restaurants, okay, and then some Japanese restaurant thrown in, and one from Mexico City and one from Lima, Peru.
Right.
You know? And so, I mean, it's a fantastic example. I have this kind of this beautiful sociological study of Japanese food in Hawaii written kind of, this is a study from the end of the 19th century to the early 20th century. And it's amazing how self-conscious the Japanese are about their food, because it's considered the food of the poor and unsophisticated cuisine. And they are being, in some ways, berated by their children to Americanize their food to make it more sophisticated. That sounds like absurdity today when look how Japanese cuisine re-entered, not through the ethnic population, but through in some ways the foreign population. I would make that distinction, where in fact Japanese cuisine entered American cities through Midtown, through Japanese managers in the kind of follow-up to the great boom in the Japanese economy, 1970s
right.
and 1980s, and you have the most expensive restaurant in New York City is a Japanese restaurant.
So two questions, uh-huh. and then we'll wrap up. But the first one is, can you talk a little bit about very quickly how immigration has and immigrant communities and the size of those communities uh-huh. affects if a cuisine is sort of ghettoized to lower end ethnicity or like ethnic cuisine or like Japanese kind of brought up?
Yeah. My studies show that, in fact, there's kind of almost an inverse relationship between popularity and prestige. And popularity of a cuisine is often related to the number of immigrants coming in. Large number of immigrants, poor immigrants, often in neighborhoods, you will have these cheap and interesting eateries that, since the end of the 19th century, intellectuals, artists would kind of go slumming there, within quotation marks. On the other side is the cuisine of basically the elites that enters the Japanese cuisine, being the other example, a good example of it, comes from the midtown and its prestige goes up. So we have the most expensive restaurants, a Japanese restaurant. And I think that is a relationship that we still have in the U.S., that we have great respect for foreign cuisines and relatively low respect in terms of prestige for immigrant cuisines, which is what we call ethnic cuisines. Right. So I think it's very important. If French is seen as foreign, then it gets valorized, increased value. If Japanese is seen as foreign, it has increased value. And Indian cuisine is in some ways playing in those two domains. It is a very middle-class cuisine driven partly by poor South Asian immigrants, Bangladeshi immigrants, Pakistani immigrants, who run 80% of Indian restaurants in New York City. And then all the top-end Indian restaurants in New York City are run by Indian immigrants or basically expats who have just invested. So they are trying to kind of struggling against the weight of this poorer immigrant population.
Right.
So in some ways, it happened with the Italians too. It happened with Jews. It happened Eastern European Jews. It happened with Germans. When you have a large number of immigrants, you have their cuisines available and visible, but cheap. And it's very difficult to climb up the ladder, like you see with Chinese cuisine. It's so difficult to charge $20, $25 for an entree in Chinese cuisine as it is with Indian cuisine.
And those things, Well, there's two questions that I have, and we could go on all night, but the two questions I have are, A, is that because most of the immigrants from, like, Eastern European Jews and Italians, those were poor immigrants, so it's not like they were bringing the cuisine of kings here, right? So, in some ways, the cuisine was...
Yeah, I think there's a contamination effect. It's about, in some ways, where taste is about hierarchy. There's almost very difficult to think about taste outside of hierarchy, and we cannot usually associate greatness with poor people's culture. Wrong, but we can't usually associate with poor people's culture. And most immigrants have been poor, and they have been condemned to that corner of ethnic cuisine. Though there have been some movement. The Japanese cuisine is a terrific example of some movement, but the movement has come from two different directions.
Right.
As long as the Japanese were poor immigrants, nobody respected their cuisine. When the Japanese became rich midtown visitors and managers, we started respecting their cuisine. And so I think that's where the sociology of taste and prestige and popularity is very interesting, as is happening with, for instance, Greek is going through a series of upgrading.
Right.
Precisely when Greek immigration has effectively stopped. So my idea is that proximity...
If the Indians stop coming to America, we'll have much higher-end Indian restaurants.
I would bet, in that case, in Chinese in 20 years.
Yeah.
If the Chinese economy keeps growing at the rate at which it is growing, there will be a fall-off of Chinese immigration. And then finally, we may be able to upscale because it'll be foreign food, and then we can respect foreign things. We cannot respect the intimate, proximate other. Who's the ethnic other?
Christian Andrew Ray, this has been a pleasure. Thank you so much. It's true, but also absurd. And we'll be back after a short break with some wonderful music. It is foreign, not immigrant. Thank you so much.
Listening to Signal Dub by Evan Hashi.
Today's program was brought to you by Rolling Press. Rolling Press is a family-run digital and offset print house that brings together eco-friendly methods, ethical practices, and personalized service. Using environmentally responsible papers, non-toxic inks, and wind power, Rolling Press represents the harmony of traditional craftsmanship and mindful sustainability. Rolling Press offers advice on reducing paper waste and energy consumption, helping you save money and minimize your carbon footprint. For more information, visit rollingpress.com.
Hey, my name is Betsy Andrews, executive editor of Severa Magazine, and I am hanging out at the coolest, most delicious place in the world, heritageradionetwork.org.
Now it's time for a musical guest who's gonna sing a song or two.
I'd like to welcome to the studio Samir Gupta on tabla and Abhik Mukherjee from the Brooklyn Raga Massive. Gentlemen. I feel like jumping up and clapping and dancing. It was so wonderful.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Josh.
It's just such a pleasure to be in the presence of this. You guys are clearly having such a good time when you're doing it. Tell me what you're communicating when you're smiling at each other.
Actually, when the tabla starts, we start counting. So we were the points, we were making calculations and, you know, attempts to come to the first beat of the cycle or come to the, you know, the starting point of the composition. So each time is a calculation, each time it's excitement because everything is improvised. So that's why we look at each other and communicate.
Yeah, I think, of course, the calculations and everything are very much there. I think that's a lot of the technical things we're doing, and it's always very high level, especially in classical music. But with Abik, it's particularly joyous and beautiful and soulful, and yeah. I think that is what makes him particularly beautiful. And I think it's a pleasure to play.
It's likewise, you know, it's a pleasure to play with.
It's a very rare thing. I mean, me and Abik, I think the last time we played was maybe months ago.
Yeah,
and,
definitely.
Even though we both live in Brooklyn, you know, we have like a lot of the same community. We see every day and every week. Sometimes you don't always get the chance to play together, and so it's really a special treat.
Well, I'm happy that I had one venue for you guys to play together.
It's such a cool venue you have.
I really love this venue. This is amazing.
It's really great. Beautiful. Well, I loved having you guys.
Thank you.
Tell us when is Brooklyn Raga Massive?
Yeah, Brooklyn Raga Massive is basically this artist collective that we started a few years back. If you go to brooklynragamassive.com, you can learn a lot about it. We have a huge New Year's party coming up. It's going to be like a regal raga celebration at a place called Art Cafe in Prospect Heights. It's at the corner of Underhill and Pacific, and it's December 31st. You can check it out on brooklynragamassive.com, but it's going to have multiple artists.
Yeah, that would be great and a big one.
It's going to be a really cool party, and we're going to have all this Indian music and Indian-inspired music, and we've been hosting a weekly session for about 3 years dedicated to Indian music and Indian-inspired music, and it's like a raga jam session. A lot of really amazing Indian classical musicians are coming together and doing it like a jazz jam session, and that was originally my my concept was to try and sort of light a fire in the Indian classical scene at the same level where the jazz community comes together and networks and shares the artists network and meet and play, and it's very informal. And
tell us when it's Wednesday nights.
Okay. Our weekly session is on Wednesday nights at Art Cafe, and the address I think is 884
Pacific Street.
It's at the corner of Pacific and Underhill at Prospect Heights, Brooklyn.
Okay, that's wonderful.
And
thank you.
I know
guys.
Abik has a big project going on right now too.
Yeah. So tell us. I got a CD released. And so the tracks are available at Bandcamp. So that's going on. So
yeah, and you can check out.
We'll put a link on our show.
Yeah. Abik Mukherjee's website,
ABHIKMUKHERJEE.com. Yeah, I know the name is a bit complicated, but particularly the surname, but
it's worth it.
It's as complicated as the cuisine. Trust me.
Thank you. Okay, well, that's our show tonight. This is the Joshua David Stein Variety Hour, half hour. I'd like to thank all of our guests tonight. Krishnendu Ray for the first half, Samir Gupta and Abik Mukherjee, and as always our wonderful engineer Liz.
Thank you, Liz.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Liz. Thank you, Josh.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.